Hi, Food Fans. Alton Brown here. Welcome to the Alton Browncast. We've got a pretty interesting show today, and it is going to all center around today's interview, which is with one of the guys that I most admire in the food space, as we call it. He is a leading food writer, a food, you know, I'm gonna say he's a cooking advocate. Actually, he's a huge believer in home cooking. He's, I think, an expert on almost any ingredient that he takes on. And he has worked tirelessly with a lot of very, very big chefs in America to write books with and for them. Anyway, his name is Michael Ruhlman, and I met him in the very first year of the Next Iron Chef competition. Amazingly smart guy, and a very, very, I think, and I'm saying this in all seriousness, an important voice in the food scene. He's also got an amazing head of hair, which is just, I'm sorry you're not going to be able to see on the show. It's so full, and I don't know how he does it at his age. Anyway, Michael Ruhlman will be on the show, so stick around. This is Alton Brown. This is the Alton Brown cast recording this week from my dressing room at Iron Chef America. And I'm talking with Michael Ruhlman, who has been, well, we'll talk about how many times you've done this kind of thing and how long we've been working. But we met on the very first season of Next Iron Chef.
Correct.
Do you remember that?
I do indeed.
Do you remember how long ago that was?
It seems like a long time ago.
Doesn't it?
How long ago was it? When was it?
2000 and... I'm going to be really honest with you. I don't know.
I think it's like 2004.
2004, 2005.
Five, yeah.
And those were the good old days because we used to go like really fun places. We went to Paris.
That was a blast.
So you and I met on Next Iron Chef, and it was a very different culinary landscape then, I think. It was the, do you think that at that point in time, chefs were already jaded the way they are now? Or do you think that chefs are jaded? And I have to say, because any audience member that doesn't know you, you are a cook in your own right. But the thing that to me makes you so interesting is as a writer, you have three kinds of books to my mind. You have books that have nothing to do with food. You wrote a great book about boats when you actually moved out to, was it Nantucket or
Martha's
Cape Cod?
Vineyard?
Martha's Vineyard to work that book. So you write about things that don't have anything to do with food. You've written three of my favorite books in dealing with cooking in the last couple of decades, and we'll get to those. But you also write probably better than anyone else about what goes inside the noggins of actual chefs. And you've spent some pretty intimate time with big dogs,
mm-hmm.
The Kellers, really big people. So from that standpoint, when I ask you about our chefs or, you know, the chef community getting jaded, I guess that's the perspective I'm asking you from, you know, from that kind of insider. Do you think that something has actually shifted and changed in the collective consciousness of chefdom?
I don't think I'd use the word jaded. I'm not sure what you mean by jaded. What would cause
maybe not jaded, but has TV and media changed something deep within the DNA of the chef brain?
I think that they all expect or hope for some TV, for celebrity, in ways they never did before, say 1999, when I really started writing about this whole world. Now people get into the business in order to be celebrities, and I think that's the wrong reason to do it. I think it sets a wrong message for young, aspiring chefs. And I think that it does not serve the restaurant community well when a chef expects to have their book, expects to have a TV show. I think that's setting up the wrong expectations.
Do you think that is actually changing food in America?
Well, it really has changed. It's changed to the point where I almost feel like I'm starting to feel almost irrelevant at this point.
I mean, why would you say that? Why?
Because, you know, I wrote a book called Charcuterie.
Yes, which is one of those three books that I wanted to talk about that, as far as I'm concerned, are some of the finest books around. It's a fantastic book.
No one had really covered that. No one had the audacity to write a book about animal fat and salt in this salt-fat-phobic country. we wrote about this art of curing and salting meats, and it did fabulously well, continues to do well. We're having a second edition, revised edition coming out. But since then, there's been just sort of a wave of fermenting and meat curing and all kinds of books like that that are getting even more and more detailed. And people are obsessing about smaller and smaller, smaller and smaller areas. It's like the medical field got more and more
specialized.
And I'm not really interested in those really fine specialties. I'm interested in general technique. I'm interested in helping people to cook better at home and understand the importance of cooking our own food.
Well, you talk about specializing, but you did write a book on schmaltz, which some people would say is a pretty fine specialization.
That was a little experimental book that my wife and I published to the iPad, and Little Brown liked it so much they wanted to bring it out as a book, and so they're doing it. What I found something that I was curious about and passionate about, and I wrote a short subject book about it. And it does well. I don't know why no one had thought to do a book about schmaltz. But I'm finding that I have fewer and fewer ideas and less inclination to write about specific cooking specialties like, specialty herbs or single ingredients. I'm doing a series of four books on technique for Little Brown as well, also short subjects. I think that's the way books are going now, because I don't think people want 300 recipes in a book anymore. I think they want 20 really good recipes in a small, affordable book that teaches them something, that gives them a technique that allows them to cook just by thinking about it, by thinking through it, not needing a recipe.
Right. Well, you're talking about understanding something about food. You're talking about having actual power over food. And one of the things that you and I have in common is that we have tried in our work to make sense of food in such a way that frees people from the tyranny of the recipe, which is really just food media's way of selling you the same thing over and over again. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's true.
It's true.
Once you understand how to braise something, you can all of a sudden start looking at magazines and say, oh my God, this is the same recipe over and over again, only with a chimichurri here and a curry paste here. It's really, and you know, the one book that someone else has written that I wish I could kill that person and steal their book would be you in 20, because you're right. People say, well, what do you really have to know? I'm like, I used to say there's maybe 15 to 30 basic tenets of cooking, but you actually nailed it. There are, in fact, 20, not including all the baking, of course, which, you know, would get us into a whole other ball of wax.
True.
But once you just start to understand things, everything starts to make sense. And you realize, if I can make an omelet, there's not that much difference between this and a hollandaise. There's not much difference between a souffle and this over here. And things become unified by understanding rather than this kind of big mysterious treasure map thing that we have.
Right. I love to use the example of the dough batter continuum. If you start at one end, you've got bread dough, which is very stiff, and then it gets moving to pie dough, and then it gets looser in pot au chou, and then it tips over into batter. Right. And you've got looser and looser batters from quick breads down to pancakes
and
down
crepes.
To crepes.
Which
exactly.
is one of the thinnest, or a tempura maybe, or
something
like that.
And they're all the same thing, more or less.
It's changing out parts and. But your belief is that if you understand that stuff, if you can actually understand those relationships, you're automatically a better cook.
Yes.
Would you agree?
Absolutely.
So you feel that the little books, you know, of course, we used to not be able to write little cookbooks because you couldn't get them on bookstore shelves. A cookbook in this country had to have at least 80 recipes. That was kind of the unspoken minimum in order to get on a shelf. And so that's why you have these huge compendiums, which I have to tell you, as a writer, I don't have that attention span to develop a book like that.
Nor do I. I can't stand recipes. I hate writing recipes.
You know what? I like recipes in the way that I like poetry. I like them if they go together to all say one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I've been wanting for a while to write a turkey cookbook that has like maybe 10 to 20 recipes.
You've been talking about that for a while.
I told you about this turkey book. But the thing is that, you know, I can figure ways to put together a small collection where everything makes sense. It's like more of a curated collection of this is here for a reason, this is here for a reason, this is here for a reason, which is kind of what you did. Well, what you did with 20 was different than that. But as you're going forward with these new small books, can you share some of the ideas behind those?
Yeah, the first one is Roast. there's going to be sort of basic technique and more specialized technique. So we're going to do a roast book. We're going to do a braise book with 20 recipes each illustrating all the uses of braise. And then we're going to do a sous vide book for the home, and a preservation or a canning, I think, is going to be the fourth one down the road.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you do a lot of sous vide yourself?
Not a lot, but it's something that I'd like to explore. And I'm sensing more and more people want to know how to do it.
Yes.
And we did that big book with Thomas Keller, Under Pressure, which is about four-star cuisine using sous vide. I'd like to do it for the home, to make it more accessible for our cooks at home.
I want to write a pressure cooker book.
That's another great thing. I just discovered the pressure cooker over the past couple of years, and it's absolutely amazing.
It shocks me how often in the time that I've spent in Kitchen Stadium and shows like Iron Chef America, how few restaurant chefs actually know how to use pressure cookers.
Right.
They can't even get the lid on. And just because it's not something that – it's funny. I don't even remember who the chef was. It was a couple of seasons into Next Iron Chef, where it's like, this has just got no business in a restaurant kitchen. I thought – really? It's a time machine. You couldn't use that in your kitchen? So it's kind of interesting. When are these books going to be published?
The first one will be out next fall. And then, I don't know, if you don't do that turkey pretty soon, you may find it stolen from right out from under you.
I have to admit that the thing that keeps me from doing it is just being so depressed about the publishing industry in general.
Well, we've talked a lot about our options.
I know. But you actually got up the cojones to do something and actually did an iPad book.
Mm-hmm.
You actually did it.
I did it. Yeah, I'm really proud of that.
And you should be. Number one, it was a great project for you and your wife, because your wife's a photographer and a good one. So you had a family project, and then you actually had somebody willing to pick it up as a book and run with it. And I think that model right there is what we're going to see more and more, that you're basically going to have to make the book virtually first.
Yeah.
And then turn around and sell the print rights to
it. I think you're right.
I think that, you know, we had talked about this before you did it, and I came close to doing it, decided I didn't have the time because luckily I had some television work, but you've actually proven that it works.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine that lets us how many voices that could allow into the publishing arena.
Yeah, there's a downside to that too, is that there could be too many voices and the good ones could be lost.
Yeah.
That's the downside. But the upside is you've got a finished product, and the publisher knows what they're dealing with. And it's up to you to take the risk. And I think the content creator should take the risk and reap their rewards.
Absolutely.
Or not, if their product isn't good enough.
It's a gamble.
Yeah.
You've worked so much with big name chefs, geniuses. I mean, you think it's an okay word to apply. You have had the opportunity to work with some real genius chefs.
Yes, I define genius.
Okay. Well, let's not say genius. Let's say people who are original, highly skilled, and have in a lot of ways had great influence over food in this country in the last 10 to 20 years.
Yeah. Thomas Keller is a great example. He's one of the most observant chefs I've ever encountered. I've learned so much from him. He has a way of thinking about not just food, but the world that he channels toward food, and this has allowed him to teach us how to think about food and how to think about cooking and what it means.
What makes these people different in their heads? You've observed enough of them now. Are they wired different? What is it that sets them apart from the rest of us?
The first thing, and I know you'll agree with me here, is they have an extraordinary capacity for working long hours. They have amazing energy.
Stamina. Go.
Yeah. They also have the capacity to do the same thing over and over and over again and somehow like that. One of Keller's favorite things to do is peel asparagus. He could peel asparagus all day long or turn artichokes. I hate turning artichokes. It's a pain. But he loves it. He tries to perfect it. So there's a type A energy. There's the capacity for long stretches of mundane work, and also the adrenaline rush of service. When I worked at the grill station, a nice restaurant in Cleveland, I dreaded service. I just got so nervous. Somehow chefs love that pressure, and it brings out some sort of endorphin rush or something like that.
Did you ever get over that?
that feeling?
No. I was so relieved when I finally got that French Laundry contract to write that book. It allowed me to quit the kitchen and go on writing.
I remember getting into the kitchen. I mean, in my time in professional kitchens, I'd get there two and a half, three hours before my shift. Because I was so nervous about my station being wiped out by lunch or whatever that I wouldn't have my prep done in time. That was my big fear, was just getting the trench dug before the enemy attacked. Because it's like going to war. I mean, in maybe not in super fine dining, but you know, in a medium, you know, I guess it'd be called fine dining, where you're going to maybe turn 150, 200 covers a night in a small restaurant with maybe three people on the hotline and two in the pantry. It's war.
Yeah. It certainly feels like that. And after a really great service, I mean, you almost feel like headbutting your...
Exactly. Yeah. Because you made it. Because you survived another night.
Exactly.
You didn't get killed.
And it's a great feeling. And I'll never forget it when it happened to me, when I just got buried. I almost let my fire go out. And it's a trauma. I remember a young chef at Trio, when Grant was there, he ran out of bacon that was required for one of the dishes. And it was absolute, utter humiliation for him. Nothing was really spoken.
Didn't have to be. That's the worst kind of humiliation.
And I went up to him 5 years later, and he says, "Remember the night of the bacon?" He just looked at the ground in shame and shook his head. Of course he remembered.
Yeah. Did you ever have a moment of hideous shame like that?
I did. I was working the grill station at Sans Souci in Cleveland, and... steak after steak after steak. There were so many steaks fired that anytime after a certain point, the whole line just started laughing at me because they kept calling steak. I was in a sea of steaks. I didn't have time to put more wood on the fire, and the expediter had to come back and put wood on the fire for me and just looked at me in disgust and say, "Man, don't let your fire go out."
Oh. That's kind of like you wet your pants a little or something.
Yeah. And he knew it was a bad night, and he asked me, you know, we never went out. He asked me to come out with the other cooks, have a drink afterwards, which was sort of a sign of, "Sorry, man, you had a really bad night." And I did. I'll never forget it. And it never happened again, though. You know, the next day, you were ready. This is never going to happen to me again. Never.
I grill station, we same thing. The time that it was so bad that I literally... My mind actually for a moment contemplated running for the door when I literally had 17 steaks down at once on wood, you know, wood, and you're trying to do heat management.
How many rares?
I started cheating. And what I would do is on really busy nights, I would actually take the steaks out and let them come to room temperature. I would hide them so that I wouldn't have to worry about getting them cooked from refrigerator temperatures. I would give myself the jump of getting them to room temp, which of course is against every, you know, rule
health
that you're taught. Well, only, you know, to a point, what's really going to happen. But that way I could, you know, I could shave 3 minutes off of a medium rare steak.
Yeah. Saturday nights I'd often mark some off just because I knew I was going to get hammered.
I've dropped them in the deep fryer. I admit it. I have dropped steaks in the deep fryer.
That'll work.
I swear to God.
That will work well.
You got to mark them first. Uh-huh. Mark them first. You know,
it works great, but it kills the fry oil.
Oh my God, the fry oil. You got to change it that night. I mean, you're done because the tallow. It's disgusting. So we share that trait of. Would you ever go in there again?
I don't think I'm approaching 50. I couldn't do it. My knees and my back just wouldn't do it. And, you know, I put my thermometer out at my station. Mm-hmm. It was 150 degrees ambient temperature at my station.
Yeah. And that's, grill station, people don't realize the amount of heat. You see the hoods. You figure there's enough makeup coming into the space. No, it's and you would drink 8 liters of water.
Yeah. I mean, you're cooking yourself.
And never go pee because you never need to.
Right. You know? Right. That's well done.
That's
150.
That's right. You wouldn't need a steak cooked to 150. Certainly, when you have a pork chop. Well, this is why, you know, like in France in the good old days, in the Carême days, you drop dead at 40.
Right.
I mean, 45, you were the old man because you've been breathing, you know, charcoal dust and coal fumes since, you know, you were 14 years old or 12 years old.
Right.
So guys like Keller have, you've said, the ability, the stamina. Mm-hmm. And this fixation on perfection that allows for repetition.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
The ability to learn, to take lessons that you see, whether it's driving or cooking. For instance, there are some people just more aware. I mean, you're driving down the highway. Some people are just kind of just driving down the highway, but other people, without looking behind them, know that they've got a car in their blind spot on one side, and they know they got a fast car way back coming up on them.
Right.
You know,
they're aware.
They're aware, and you develop an awareness in the kitchen and a kitchen sense. That allows you to get more done in less time, to accomplish more with fewer actions. And those who can do that become very successful chefs.
I didn't know what that used to mean. I mean, I knew what it meant, but I couldn't do it until, oddly enough, when I turned 40, started riding motorcycles and learned that if I didn't have utter awareness of everything within, 200 feet of me all the time, that I would end up dead. Mm-hmm. Soon, literally all the time scanning what's over here, what's over there, where am I going to go when this happens? And I think that in a kitchen, I wish I'd had that skill in a restaurant kitchen, because then not only would I have been better off myself, I would have been more useful to other people around me.
Sure.
Because I would have known what was going on saute. I would have known what was going on the, on sommelier. Everybody would have been on my radar instead of me being tunnel visioned on my steaks or my chops or whatever.
Right. That's the dance that they talk about, is when everyone has that same group awareness.
And they're in sync with each other.
And so that they know where the guy on their left is going to be moving when they need to move somewhere else. And he knows where you're going. So that so it is almost literally like a dance.
You talk about that humiliation that with the steaks, the same kind of scowling contempt happens in a kitchen on a busy night when you're out of sync and you turn around and you burn somebody with the edge of a pan or something because you were out of sync with the dance, and everybody looks at you like,
you're dangerous. Stay away from him.
You're dangerous. You're terrible. It kind of makes me, I'm getting a little sweaty palm thinking back to some of the nights that I endured in my 30s. How old were you when you were doing that?
I was 34.
So you're an old guy too.
Yeah.
See, I was as well. We went to culinary school
about
at basically the same ages.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to CIA and I went to NECI.
Mm-hmm.
And then we flung ourselves into places where we probably didn't completely belong, but we did it anyway.
Well, you were very smart. You did it before I did. And I think we were both very smart in understanding that we needed to know basic technique. And once we knew that, then we had the language of the kitchen. We had the language of chefs. And that gave us entree into anywhere. When you know the language of a culture, you can go in the back alleys. You can go where other people wouldn't. Right.
Because it is a culture. And if you don't live in that culture, at least for a while, you're never going to be part of it, mm-hmm. and even in the fringes of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you say that. And I'm sure the credibility that you have to talk to people like Thomas Keller comes out of the fact that you have lived in the trenches.
Yes. I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Have things changed that much in the kitchens, do you think? Do you think that the environment that both you and I faced some years ago, well, coming up on 20 years, do you think that environment is different now?
It's much different. I think that it is much more professional. Mm-hmm. The standards are much higher. The food is getting better. Chefs take themselves more seriously. And in order, if you're any good, you're going to live up to your own expectations of yourself and your work environment. And so I think the kitchen has become a much friendlier place to work and a much better place to work, producing better food.
It's interesting that you mentioned friendlier. I interviewed, the first chef that I interviewed for the podcast is Hugh Atchison out mm-hmm. of Athens, Georgia, who literally treats his kitchen, it's almost like the whole place is one community. And he feels the nurturing that community is as important as the ingredients that he buys in this food. This is completely unheard of when I was in kitchens, where it was simply my duty to cook and burn and bleed and whatever else.
Right. It was humiliation was how you got things done.
Right.
Threat of humiliation.
Yeah. The old school Moby Dick style.
Right. Exactly.
Cooking where, exactly. Ahab kind of ruled. So I'm wondering, you say that so many chefs now and even cooks that are just starting have this vision of what success is going to be, which is not feeding people or maybe one day having their own restaurant, but being, picking out the interior of their jet and having an empire, right?
Right.
When you combine that with chefs that are creating more user-friendly communities in their kitchens, what's the end result? What's the chef 20 years from now going to look like and act like?
I don't know. I think it will probably revert back to the way it was when enough people realize that this is really hard work, And you've got to be committed to this way of life. It is a way of life. And that's why they do create communities in their restaurant kitchens. It's just too hard otherwise. You need the support. If you're going to be working 14-hour days, six to eight of those hours really hustling, working the line hard.
Hard.
I think more people are going to realize what it takes to be a chef and choose not to be or find other outlets for their culinary interests.
Food shows on television. Force for good or force for evil?
I don't watch a lot of food TV myself. I find it to be a little boring. I always loved your shows because, and my kids loved your shows because I learned something. And you had a way of helping us to visualize what was happening to our food. So you're actually teaching us something.
Outrageous talk, by the way. you can't do that anymore.
You can't. And it's become entertainment now, and I don't find it very entertaining. So I think that there's going to be another wave of new television. I hope that I'm going to be a part of it in the form of a scripted drama for TV. We're talking with HBO about a scripted drama, that is almost entirely culinary.
It drove me crazy for years that I was categorized, and thank you for saying what you did about Good Eats, being categorized in the unscripted category when I have, 75 banker boxes of Good Eats scripts, in a storage facility down in Atlanta, because every word was scripted.
I know you told me that. I was always amazed. I was like, how does he do that? I mean, he talks nonstop without reading a word. How is this happening?
I also believe that I'm more interested now in either short form storytelling, which is going to be web-based, story and education, and then also more dramatic forms, because we've used now, I think in food media, we've used up a lot of avenues of food's possibility. The reality thing we've played, but no one has really gone for the scripted approach. But very few companies can play in that avenue, because scripted costs a lot of money.
That's right.
It involves more people. It involves people that get residuals. It is a very, very, very different kind of animal. But to me, it's the last frontier that actually sounds fun.
I do too. I can't imagine anything else. But I'm glad you isolated the storytelling, because I think that's what's going to drive food information into the future. We are the only animal that cooks our food, and we're the only animal that for whom story is fundamental to our existence. It's more important than it's second in importance to food and nourishment. More important than love. More important than shelter. People survive without shelter, without love. Almost nobody survives in silence, and as soon as silence is broken, that breaking of silence results in story. This is how
narrative. Mm-hmm. Well, narrative, I can't remember who said this, but I remember someone said that story is the only thing that keeps time from driving us insane, because it's the only way that we can order time is with story, with narrative. It's the music of time, in a way.
It is indeed. It's the way we order chaos. We wouldn't be able to function if we didn't order the chaos around us. And we do that through story.
Are there any food movements that drive you wacko right now? Anything going on? I just want to preface that by saying all food movements drive me wacko.
Yes, I was going to say
in a way,
that.
But is there anything that you see going on in the food world that just makes you shake your head and want to smack yourself or somebody else?
When food movements take on a moralistic tone, they bother me. I'm better than you because I eat this way.
I drink this raw milk, and I am therefore care about my family more than you.
Exactly.
Do that
stuff. I think that's harmful and wrong, and I hope it goes away soon. I don't like veganism. I think there's an argument that it's inhumane, that we are meant to consume at least the products of animals, and if we don't, those animals will die out.
Yes. Well, to me, veganism is almost just an avoidance of proper stewardship. It's like, I'm not going to take responsibility for how I handle animals, so I'm just going to turn my back on the whole thing.
Good point.
I also just don't want to live that life. No eggs, really.
That's crazy.
No cheese.
Now my next book is on the egg.
The egg, the single most powerful. When I get sick of cooking, I'm sure it happens to you because you've worked on it. All I have to do is cook eggs, which is why breakfast is always my favorite meal. And whenever I'm home in Atlanta, I always cook for my daughter and stuff in the morning, because to me, getting up and having the first thing I do, eggs, is like a great reset button for me. Eggs are the liquid meat that holds everything together.
Yeah, right? They got all the stuff of life all inside it.
Everything. And culinarily speaking, where can the egg not go?
That's what my book is all about. It's, you know,
and that could be a thick book.
It is a bigger book.
That could be a very thick book.
Yep.
Because once we move through custards and we move through foams and we move, it's inexhaustible.
It is. Yeah. In fact, my proposal to the publisher was a flow chart of all the things that you could do with an egg. It started with I was trying to figure out what can't you do with that? Well, how do you organize all this? Well, you can cook it in its shell or out of its shell. If you cook it in its shell, you can cook it hard, soft, medium. Mm-hmm. If you take it out of its shell, you can fry it, you can deep fry it, you can poach it, you can bake it, and that's even whole. Then you can cook it out of its shell, blend it. When you blend it, here's what you can do with it. You can poach it, you mm-hmm. can fry it, mm-hmm. etc. And so this flow chart was like 5 feet long of all the stuff you can do, and each one ended in a recipe that exemplifies that end of the flow chart chain.
It's interesting that you bring up, for you, it seems that in order to get a grasp of something, and maybe we're similar in this, you've got to be able to organize it first. You want to organize and figure out how you're going to organize and categorize. So mm-hmm. you come up with a flow chart that involves inside of the shell, outside of the shell. I remember when I wrote a baking book, and I couldn't write the book until I figured out the organizational angle. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it turned out to be mixing methods. At all to me.
That's I could what it's see all about. It. I have that book.
I could see it if I could figure out, okay, oh, it's this method versus this method. And then everything kind of fell together. Do you do that kind of organizational thing for all your projects?
I think it just happens naturally, as it happened naturally for you. You couldn't get your arms around it until you had this framework that.
How are you
gonna categorize? And mixing method is what defines baking. So much of baking.
Yeah. But for you, the egg really comes down to inside of the shell and outside of the shell?
But also egg as tool uh-huh. and emulsifier, egg as garnish, raw or cooked. Again, 5 feet of flowchart.
And a big scroll of parchment paper. I could see that being a problem. But you know, the thing is if you organize that right, it might lead you to do something with eggs that nobody's even done yet with eggs, which is hard to imagine, but possible.
Possible. I didn't come up with anything that hasn't been done except for, and I tweeted this, putting an egg on dessert. Putting it on, finishing it, like I finish all kinds of plates with some form of egg, like a pasta dish with an egg on top or a sandwich with an egg on top. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't put an egg on chocolate cake or ice cream or anything like that. But I'm
well,
sure
the ice cream's probably already got egg in it.
Yeah, but you know, we put hollandaise on a poached egg.
Yeah.
And that's a yolk-based emulsion.
So why don't we just put melted ice cream on top of the poached egg and skip the hollandaise?
That actually, okay, that might work.
Make a lemon, a really rich lemon ice cream, and melt that right on top of our Eggs Benedict and call it a day.
We're going to have to try that.
Yeah, I think
that's
so.
Maybe sugar. So how do we get this? The eggs would need some sweetness.
We need some sweetness. The thing is we could use a sugar-cured ham. Or have more sweetness in the pork product. All right, Michael, thanks for coming by. Appreciate it. Look forward to you judging on Iron Chef. Do you still enjoy that at all?
Oh, it's a blast. Yeah, it's fun.
Have you, the time that you've spent on both Next Iron Chef and Iron Chef America, are there still dishes that float to the top and sink to the bottom in your head?
A lot of the great dishes I have don't stick with me, but there's one dish that I will never forget. It's Chris Cosentino's kidney. Uh-huh. Chris is a great chef and
fantastic
a friend,
chef.
But these kidneys were awful. It was battle awful. That's what it was for.
Battle offal. Yeah, offal. You're absolutely right. And yet he also made a fried tripe that was a dessert in the first Next Iron Chef competition.
That's right.
That was actually fantastic.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. So some of the best and some of the worst all in one place. Well, hopefully the rest of your meals in Kitchen Stadium will be delicious.
Thank you, Alton. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Food fans, that's all we've got on the Alton Brown cast today. Thanks for listening. Also want to thank Michael Ruhlman for doing, number one, what he does so well, and for managing to spend a little time with us today. So thank you very much for that. So until next time, America, hopefully there'll be a next time. Hopefully I'm not going to lose this thing between now and next week. I don't think I will. Anyway, until then, cook smart.